listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm happy to have with me for the first time Christopher Whalen, who is well-known in the world of finance for his candid truth-telling, especially when it comes to the banking industry. Christopher is the ultimate Wall Street insider, but he is one who I believe provides an objective vision of financial reality that is often, if not usually, missing from the mainstream narrative. Christopher has worked in politics at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and as an investment banker for more than 30 years, and he is considered one of the most incisive and thoughtful financial analysts on Wall Street. He covers a wide range of subjects from banking to housing to global economics and the financial reserve, or in the Federal Reserve. He is the author of three books, Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream, Financial Stability, Fraud, Confidence, and the Wealth of Nations, and most recently, a book titled Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise. Christopher publishes the blog Washington and Wall Street and contributes to many publications and appears in media outlets, including CNBC, Bloomberg, The Wall Street Journal, and you can follow him on Twitter under the handle R.C. Whalen. That's spelled W-H-A-L-E-N. Welcome, Christopher, and thanks for joining me today on Turning Hard Times into Good Times. You know, it's really an honor to have you with me on this show. I've listened to you many times with Tom Keene on Bloomberg and various other venues in the past, and I've always loved your honesty and lack of political correctness. So it is indeed an honor to have you join me today. Thank you so much for being with me.
Yeah, my pleasure, Jay. It's always great to be on the radio.
It's always good to hear your voice and to hear your candid views, and that's quite frankly why I'm thrilled to have you with me. You know, Chris, you're best known, at least in my mind, for your work and analysis in the banking industry, and I certainly have some questions for you along those lines if you're willing to discuss those. But let's start out first by giving our listeners a little information about your latest book, Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise. You know, given your strong background in the banking industry, what prompted you to write a book about the Ford Motor Company?
Well, really two things. First, I'm a student of the Great Depression, and mm-hmm. I was always fascinated by the role that Henry Ford played in 1932 and 33 to really make the Great Depression much worse. He essentially tried to take all his money out of the banks in Detroit, if you can imagine that. He was one of the wealthiest men in America at the time. So that, you know, Herbert Hoover begged him not to do this. They tried for months to change his mind. And right before Lincoln's birthday in early 1933, he, you know, indicated that he was going to try and take his money out of the banks, which would cause them all to collapse. Mm-hmm. So the governor of Michigan found out about this and declared a bank holiday. And 3 weeks later, when FDR took office and said there is nothing to fear but fear itself, it's because every bank in the country was closed. And that was due to Henry Ford's selfishness and short-sightedness. So I had always been fascinated by that because, as I say, I'm a student of the Depression. And then I also worked as a contributor to the Washington Times, and I did a number of articles about the Ford Explorer and the Firestone tires and mm-hmm. that whole mess. So between those two experiences, I just started working on this book 12 years ago. And I was an investment banker at the time, and I didn't have a happy ending because Bill Ford was just taking over the company, and it was kind of a miserable time for Ford, which I talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. But since then, I wrote two other books, and then I decided to finally publish Ford Men because we had a happy ending. Bill saved the company and redeemed his family's legacy. And what I tried to do with the book was just tell a story of all of the other people that you never hear about, the mm-hmm. people who actually made the company successful, because the Ford Motor Company Public Relations Department is very good at what they do, and they've kind of airbrushed the history, so you would think that Henry Ford did everything. Right. But in fact, he was a fairly dysfunctional human being. He was a lot like Steve Jobs.
That's very interesting. Well, could you possibly give us a little insight into Henry Ford, the man? What psychological characteristics were there that drove him and led to the Ford family legacy, or at least the legacy that we have been led to believe exists?
I mean, well, Henry Ford was a man with a vision. He had an idea of creating cheap transportation for Americans. And that singular vision was manifested in the Ford Motor Company. And really, for the first 50 years of the company's existence, they really only had an entry-level product. If you were, a successful businessman and you bought a Ford as your first car, you probably wouldn't buy a Ford after that because they didn't have anything else. General Motors, quickly eclipsed Ford in the first half of the 20th century. And, the Ford was compared to Chevrolet through most of that period because they were so much smaller. Henry Ford didn't invent the assembly line. That was his Danish engineer, Charles Sorensen. He didn't raise wages. That was his business partner, James Cousins, who is the man who turned it from an inspiration into an enterprise. Cousins is the gritty businessman who said to Henry Ford, "We're selling cars. I'm putting an ad in the newspaper tomorrow." Ford was a tinkerer, a perfectionist, a man who took his own advice and had two business failures before he started Ford Motor Company with some investors in Detroit. He wasn't even an officer of the company when it started because he had such a bad reputation. So there's a lot of nuance to the Ford story that I think is important for Americans today. It tells about how important luck is in business and being in the right place at the right time. If Henry Ford hadn't met the people who backed him and got him off the ground, he probably would have faded into obscurity, and we'd be sitting here talking about the Dodge brothers instead. In fact, Horace Dodge was one of the original shareholders of the Ford Motor Company and a parts supplier. They didn't even have a factory when they started. The Dodge brothers were building the cars as kits for them. So there's a lot of detail in the story, and it's such fun to tell because it's about America. It's a really interesting overlay for the 20th century of American history.
It is an interesting, very interesting book if you care about history and about enterprise and how things happened. It's a very enjoyable read, Christopher. And I guess what I'd like to know is you sort of touched on it. What implications does it have? This is history. We saw how one man's behavior led to a catastrophe, an economic catastrophe. Is there something to be taken away from that in current events?
Well, I think the contrast between Henry Ford and his son Edsel is very instructive. Henry Ford, with all of his personal failings and flaws, was still a very significant figure in the 20th century. But if he had had the intelligence and the compassion of his son Edsel, he would have been one of the great men of the century. By far. Edsel, probably of all the Ford family, knew the most about manufacturing cars, ironically enough. Henry didn't particularly get his hands dirty because he had people around him who could make things happen. That's really one of the key parts of the story, is you always be looking for people who can help you to build that team. And if you think of, decades later when Alan Mulally, the former Boeing executive, was brought in to save Ford Motor Company in the mid-2000s, what was he doing? He was really trying to forge a team and to take it away from the kind of plantation mentality that unfortunately has prevailed at Ford for much of the last 100 years. So I think the key thing is that you can't do things of this scale and this complexity without a lot of help and without luck, and also without the ability to change in the short term, in the tactical sense. People talk about planning a business and managing a business. But what the story of Ford really tells you is that even with a lot of management and a lot of planning, you can still screw things up on a colossal scale.
and yet
somehow survive. Because during this whole period, General Motors filed bankruptcy 3 times. And somehow Ford avoided that ignominy. So it's a fascinating tale. It really is.
Well, I just think it's a startling statement that you make. You know, something that I hadn't at all made any connection with, the idea of Henry Ford having anything to do with the Great Depression. But the fact, you know, the fact that you basically say in the preface to your book that Henry Ford caused the catastrophic banking holidays of 1933, and I see now how that is. But of course, the public relations people at Ford didn't highlight that event, that's for sure.
No, and, you know, and in fairness to Henry Ford, would the banks have failed in Detroit? Probably. But It might not have been such a catastrophe, such that it rippled across the country and caused the governors in other states to declare bank holidays. Mm-hmm. That was the real catalyst of it, and it shows, you know, think about that today. If the U.S. went through that kind of a catastrophe today and you couldn't get money out of the bank for months, and people just had to subsist. You know, cars disappeared from the streets in the 30s. Horses made a reappearance. The whole economy was on its knees. And Henry Ford made that worse. And what's interesting is the juxtaposition and the tension between Henry Ford and James Cousins, who by that time was the senator from Michigan. And where you can read about this, fascinating, is in the memoirs of Herbert Hoover. And also in the great book by Jesse Jones, $50 Billion. Jesse Jones ran the Reconstruction Finance Corporation during the 30s, and he literally restructured the U.S. economy. And he also talked about the impact of Ford's, you know, so narrow-mindedness on you know, the country. Because keep in mind, Ford took the position, he said, well, I don't care if the economy falls apart, I will rebuild. And this is such a ridiculous statement, because he was helped by so many people. If he hadn't had the group and the team around him, he never would have enjoyed that success and been in the position that he was to pull the rug out from under his whole community. So, you know, it's an interesting insight into people. And again, Henry Ford is a lot like Steve Jobs. If you look at, you know, what a difficult human being Jobs is described as, Henry Ford was worse.
It's sort of hard to imagine, but you mentioned his son Edsel had compassion, and I'm listening to what you're saying here, Chris, about, you know, I'm thinking about capitalism as a whole. We know, I think you and I are in agreement with, capitalism is the best system. It allocates scarce resources. You have incentives for people to behave well. But sometimes people take advantage of their position to not behave well. They're lacking that compassion, I think you said, that his son Edsel had. Looking back on it, if Ford had that kind of compassion, it's sort of interesting to speculate what history might have brought. But if a gentler, kindler, more kind depression, perhaps, certainly with the bank holidays and removing gold from the monetary system, or still not allowing individuals to, maybe that would have happened anyway. I don't know, but in any event.
Well, it certainly set up a great antipathy between Ford and Franklin Roosevelt. And I'm not sure, you know, there were a couple of events. First was in 1927, Ford idled his factory for over a year, because they had made the Model T for two decades, because Henry thought it was the perfect car. And meanwhile, General Motors had sprinted ahead of them with multiple product lines and a real sense of the consumer and what the consumer wanted. Henry Ford ignored what the consumer wanted. He just kept making the car cheaper in one color, black. Okay,
yeah.
So, you know, so you have this situation, and the closure of the Ford plant, many economists believe, actually contributed to the Depression, because it put so many people out of work. But the other interesting vignette is James Cousins, a very modest man who scraped up his savings and his family's money to invest in Ford. They got all their money back in the first year, and then he ends up as one of the wealthiest men in the country and goes on to a career in politics. He is the one, I believe, who insisted with Henry Ford and the other directors of the company to raise wages, because he saw the privation in Detroit in the 20s and earlier, and he saw just how hard it was, and he saw how easily he had become, you know, immensely wealthy by the standards of the day. And I think, you know, he was a modest, kind of middle-of-the-road Democrat from Michigan, great senator. And I think that really colored his political view, was how quickly he had become rich while all of his fellow Detroit, you know, residents did not enjoy that kind of prosperity.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems sort of like a Keynesian concept, essentially, is to put money in the hands of the people with a high propensity to spend, right? And that's what he did. And is that concept, it doesn't seem to be so prevalent today. You would think that Democrats would be all over that one, that they would want to have money in the hands of the middle class. But it seems as though the middle class is basically, this is off topic, of course, now, Chris, but
I would
just like to get your thoughts on that. Why? You know, because that makes perfect sense to me. Even as a free market guy, I understand that if families need to feed their family, they're going to spend the first dollar they get to do that and to put a roof over their heads. So why is that missing from the, you know, from the Democratic playbook these days?
I think that a lot of liberal economists and politicians kind of, you know, either genuinely or disingenuously miss a connection between investment and growth and productivity and, mm-hmm. and rising wages, rising real incomes. You know, there's mm-hmm. two things that really hurt income equality. One is inflation, which comes to us care of our friends at the Fed. They think 2% inflation is great. You know, over 20 years, that takes away half of your purchasing power. And then the other thing is technology. Technology is a tremendously deflationary force. Mm-hmm. It has taken many, many more jobs out of this country than immigration or free trade or anything of that nature. And I think the big challenge we all face is how do we get productivity to grow, in other words, make our people more productive, more efficient, so they can earn more. Because there's only two components to growth, population growth and productivity. Population in this country is growing half of 1% a year. After World War II, it was 2% a year. That's mm-hmm. a big difference. And that's part of the reason why it's so hard to get the economy to grow faster is you just don't have that pull the way I had when I was a kid. My parents, you know, were raising me in the 70s and the 80s. It was easy mm-hmm. to get inflation. You just spent a little more money. Today,
right.
You have the opposite situation. You have an elderly population that's mostly now spending savings. They're not buying homes or starting families. So the whole demographic profile of society is different. And between that and technology, which is constantly forcing prices down, forcing wages down, you have a difficult environment when it comes to consumer income.
Right. Well, it's certainly the technology is increasing productivity per man hour, I guess,
yes.
I would think. And
but
so,
that doesn't necessarily hand them the kind of job they're looking for. It may actually give you an example. If you put robots in McDonald's, okay, mm-hmm. once that wage rate gets up in the mid-teens, it makes sense to do it with robots instead of people.
Right. That's happening now.
Oh, it
essentially,
is.
I mean, to an extent, yeah. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, we get back to the Ford situation where, you know, paying higher wages to people actually was good for the economy, getting money into the hands of people that would spend it. And I just don't hear that discussed very much these days. I guess in general, there's tax cuts from the Republicans and Democrats always seem to oppose it. But anyway, I digress a bit from your book and the ideas of your book. But I do want to also, I don't know if there's anything else. What would you like to say to people why they should buy your book, Chris? What's the main reason? I mean, we've talked, I think it's fascinating. It's interesting reading. But give a little pitch for your book.
Well, I think it gives you insights into why businesses are successful or not. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, gives a lot of insight into people and the role that they play, not just in business, but in life in general. Because many of the vignettes from the early years of Ford and the auto industry are kind of amazing because, you know, why, for example, did James Cousins pushed to raise wages because the auto industry was so profitable. There was mm-hmm. such demand for automobiles, they could sell anything. Today, you have the opposite. You have an auto industry that's largely making commodities. They have three different types, a low-end car, a mid-range car, and a luxury car. Most automakers don't make any money. They they really are not profitable if you take a hard look at their financials. So then you say, well, why do they do it? Well, because governments want to have an auto industry. You see this all over Asia. You see a lot of irrational competitors that don't really make money, but they want to have a car industry in their country. You then have Google and Uber and Tesla, who are all bringing different types of transportation to market. Are any of them making money? Really? No. They're all operating at a loss. So it gives an insight as to why many industries around the world today struggle to be profitable and struggle to pay their workers a decent wage because there's overcapacity. You saw this back in the 20s, too, in between World War I and World War II. Huge amounts of overcapacity, excess labor caused by technology, caused by electrification and steam and all of these other inventions. So I think Ford Mann gives you a very important overview of how economies change and how people can be successful in those changing environments by also changing themselves and being flexible.
All right, I'd like to ask you a couple questions perhaps about the banking industry since you've been so much involved and you're known for your expertise in that industry, Christopher. You mentioned overcapacity, and I'm wondering if to what extent the excessive amount of money creation over the decades, whenever there's a problem, basically the Fed just starts to create money out of nothing, and other central banks around the world do the same. To what extent is that maybe causing malinvestment and money being available to go into areas that are unprofitable, such as the automobile industry, to the extent it is, as you suggest, and many other industries? Would you agree with that concept?
There is certainly a surfeit of capital available today, much more than one could deploy in a reasonable fashion. In other words, in the expectation you were going to get your money back plus a return. That's the old-fashioned definition of investing. So if you look at banking today, most of the banks are considerably less profitable than they were 30 and 40 years ago, and they tend to have to cheat or take risks that they didn't have to take, you know, many decades before, simply to get that level of earnings or apparent earnings into the hands of shareholders. You have, you know, it's defined as a surfeit of savings by economists, and they endlessly try and figure out how to get companies to invest these savings to generate jobs and income for people. But I think the reality is that many companies today face a dearth of opportunities that they really feel comfortable putting their shareholders' capital into. And no amount of cajoling and encouragement from the economist profession is necessarily going to change that. So when you look at interest rates and savings rates today, very low, and people say, well, gee, why can't I earn a decent return on my savings? I did the right thing. I was conservative. I didn't speculate in stocks. Why am I being punished? And the answer is that the central bankers, to your point, have enabled an awful lot of debt creation, especially by governments, and low rates is essentially a way to transfer money from savers to indebted governments. It's what we call financial repression. And the economists do this with a smile on their face, of course, because they are the handmaidens of the politicians. But I think that the entire financial system, banks, and particularly sovereign countries face a real issue because they have more debt than they can ever repay. And the only way they can manage it is to keep saving rates very low, which means you're punishing grandma and grandpa, who by rights ought to be benefiting from their conservatism, but they're not.
Right. Well, where is this going to end? I mean, Chris, you know, we have a $20 trillion deficit debt load, I should say, that's coming up. The debt ceiling needs to be lifted soon. You know, it's interesting to know. I would like to know who's buying treasuries these days, because from what I see, foreign governments, and for the longest time, we sort of depended on China and Japan to make up the lack of savings in this country, the lack of treasury purchases. And they seem to be going away. From what I see, there was actually a negative 12% in 2015, 2016 from foreign buyers of treasuries. Social Security Trust Fund, from what I can see, is funding less of the treasuries now because people are getting older, money is flowing out, and less money going in as the economy is weak, wages are lower, and so forth. And the Fed claims that it's no longer doing quantitative easing. How are interest rates staying low if the QE, if QE is finished and these other sources of financing aren't there, Chris? How are they managing to keep interest rates so low?
Well, for now, rates are low because all of the money creation you referred to before has been causing investors to scramble to find, you know, adequate places to put their money. As Treasury issuance of debt starts to accelerate, though, I think that dynamic is going to change, and you're going to see the current secular tightness of money and even falling interest rates. You know, think about it. Since Trump was elected, the 10-year Treasury went up to about 2.6% yield, and it's now down to 2.2 again. So even though Janet Yellen and her friends at the Fed are talking about raising interest rates, in fact, long-term rates are falling. And it's partly because investors are just so hungry for paper. But I think that you will see an evolution as U.S. deficits get larger and interest rates start to rebalance again away from government debt. You may even see government debt getting penalized because so many governments in the EU, you know, the U.S. is an example too, Japan, many other states are just up to their eyeballs in debt. And they can't pay it. So that means they're going to have to restructure or forgive some of this debt. And that will cause problems. You know, if you look at the EU, for example, with their banking system, most of the big banks in Europe are insolvent. It's very difficult to clear up a bad debt because the courts move so slowly in Europe. So it's a very hostile place for creditors and very friendly for debtors who are usually close to the political authorities in each country. And it's unlike the U.S. where our economy still functions pretty well. You know, if you have a bankruptcy or an insolvency, it gets cleared up relatively quickly. And that's the big advantage of the U.S. We have a much more dynamic and flexible economy. Look at the way our banks cleaned up all of the failed banks from 2008. Other than the government rescue of Citi, the industry paid for the entire cleanup, and the FDIC did a brilliant job of selling failed banks on a Friday with no fuss, no muss for consumers. So, you know, you compare that to the gridlock in Europe where they have been totally unable to come together and deal with their banks in a reasonable fashion. And you see the same thing in Asia. The Chinese are up to their eyeballs in debt, which they use to stimulate their economy. So, you know, all countries have an issue with debt. The question is, what other advantages do they have? And that's why the U.S. is still such a desirable venue for investors, is because we have a lot of other advantages, even though, you know, we have had a problem controlling ourselves when it comes to spending.
Chris, with just a couple of minutes left then, what's your appraisal of the U.S. banking situation? I take it you're not so worried as you might have been a few years ago. And also, you've been a fan of the smaller regional banks in the past. Where do you stand on both of those issues now with just a minute and a half left?
Well, the small banks, the mid-sized banks are where all the value creation is in the U.S. Banking system. You know, if you're looking for a real value story, that's where you should be looking. The larger banks are monopolies. They tend to have much lower returns and they take a lot more risk. So, you know, I'll give you an example. The best of the top five is U.S. Bancorp. It trades at 2x book and it's a very well-run business, no Wall Street exposure. And as a result, it trades at a premium. But I like the smaller group, you know, the Regions and the BBTs and the rest of them, because they tend to be closer to their customers and they, as a result, perform better. You're starting to see an evolution towards non-banks, too, as the big banks get out of a lot of businesses that they had previously, you know, bought up and then decimated. So that's interesting, too. There's going to be a lot of new green shoots in the world of non-bank finance that I think are important for investors to pay attention to.
Very interesting, Christopher. And I guess, do you share some of that information on your blog or some of your ideas on your blog?
Yes, I do. The blog is The Institutional Risk Analyst. And I also publish a financial newsletter, Chris Whalen's Financial Technology Investor, which is published by Agora Financial in Baltimore. And, you know, we cover the landscape, the Fed, the mortgage industry, where I spend a lot of time, and banks and the rest of it. So we have a lot of fun trying to weave all of this together in a coherent narrative. think about a mortgage company. They've been riding a roller coaster thanks to Donald Trump. And, Trump didn't know this. He didn't know that the 10-year Treasury would, retreat the way it did. But that's going to cause a 25% drop in mortgage originations this year.
Wow.
That's a big deal.
Very interesting. Well, those are some of the ideas that people can pick up from you, Christopher. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And again, folks, the book is Forward Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise. Very interesting read. And I take it, Chris, they can buy it at Barnes & Noble or online, whatever, I suppose.
Yes, it's up on Amazon. There's a Kindle version and a hardcover, which is, of course, done all in black.
Of course. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Christopher. And I hope we can do it again sometime. I really have always been a fan of yours. Enjoy your candid honesty. And it's refreshing. We need more of it. So thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Well, folks, that is all for this week. Next week, Richard Mayberry, author of the Early Warning Report, will be with us. Richard always has some astute free market observations, as well as how foreign policy matters impact the market. So I hope that you'll join me next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dynacert is a global leader in carbon emission reduction technologies. Created for use in diesel engines, the hydrogen unit has been proven to reduce carbon emissions by up to 40%, increase torque, improve engine oil quality, and provide up to 19% in fuel savings. Our leading-edge technology is designed for tractor trailers, rail, marine, and newly developed for diesel engine cars. Reducing the amount of greenhouse gases provides benefits to the environment, to communities and businesses, and to our shareholders.
Tri-Metals Mining is a growth-focused mineral exploration company exploring and developing its near-surface Gold Springs gold-silver project in mining-friendly Nevada and Utah. Tri-Metals has only drilled less than 10% of the gold targets at Gold Springs, and it already has a gold resource with a robust preliminary economic assessment. Tri-Metals believes that with further drilling, there is a significant potential to discover 3 to 5 million ounces of gold at Gold Springs. Tri-Metals shares are listed on the OTCQX and the TSX under symbols TMIAF and TMI respectively, and its website is trimetalsmining.com.